Case for today is 2012-41262, Davis versus Signal International.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Vining. I'm with the law firm LeBlanc Bland, along with my colleagues David Bland and Lee Winkleman. We represent Signal International. This is a Warren Act case. There are essentially two main issues before you today. First, the district court committed reversible error when it applied the incorrect legal standard and inapplicable case law in addressing the single site of employment issue. The district court also committed error when it found that a mass layoff occurred, despite the fact plaintiffs did not introduce evidence at trial to meet their burden of proof. And the court, rather than applying the clear, unambiguous language of the regulations, gave deference to an agency preamble, which was contradictory to the regulation itself. The Warren Act does not define the term single site of employment, but it does direct the Secretary of Labor to implement regulations in order to carry it out. As this court and the regulations generally view, two non-contiguous facilities are considered separate sites of employment, as we have here with Signal's fabrication yard and its administrative facility.
Is it your position that the Orange Yard has only fabrication staff?
It has fabrication staff, and it does have a small amount of admin-type personnel. There are people there that are admin for payroll purposes, that is, they're salaried. But for one, the yard superintendent, the yard manager, those people are sitists at the yard. We're not saying that they are admin for Warren purposes. They're fabrication personnel.
Okay. Do these staff maintain their offices exclusively at the Orange Yard,
staff? They do, Your Honor. They occasionally, as the district court pointed out, and we are not denying, sometimes those personnel went to the administration facility for certain meetings, but day in, day out, they were in the fabrication yard. Under certain circumstances, this court and the DOL will recognize non-contiguous separate sites as a single site of employment under this court's test in Viotar v. Delchamps and some other limited exceptions. Here, the district court was unable to find that the situation presented single site of employment under the Viotar test. It then turned its attention to the limited exception of the unusual business situation in relying on this court's opinion in Carpenters v. Dillard's. And this is where the court committed reversible error. In Carpenters, the standard at the time was unusual business circumstance. However, shortly after Carpenters, the standard was changed, narrowed, such that it was a heightened, truly unusual organization situation. We're not aware of this court ever addressing that discrete issue. That is the truly unusual situation, the heightened standard. But other courts in the country have noted this significant, albeit very minor, change in the law, discrete change in the law. For example, the Eastern District of Kentucky in McLean v. Laurel, that court, the plaintiffs claimed that it was so factually similar to Carpenter's that there, too, the court should find a truly unusual business circumstance. There, two formerly unified workforces were separated due to space constraints. As the court knows, in Carpenter's, a portion of the corporate division was separated due to space constraints. The court in McLean rejected that argument and found that there was nothing truly unusual about that situation. Rather, it was truly common in any business today. Similarly, Signal has a similar situation. It had a fabrication facility in one place, and it had an admin facility in another place.
Well, you agree, though, that it's a fact-intensive determination about whether or not it's a single site.
There's a lot of facts that go into it, but it's applying the law to those facts. And here, especially with the single site, the court didn't apply the correct standard. Just based on that,
What's the correct standard?
truly unusual business circumstance.
Well, now, I thought you just told me there was no case that had set out very specifically what a truly unusual circumstance is.
Right. In this circuit, this court...
So then what was the trial judge supposed to look at or examine in making that determination under these facts, other than the facts?
Well, he relied upon Carpenter's, but Carpenter's was decided under the former standard, the simply unusual. And in its findings, its conclusions of law, the district court here found that it presented an unusual business circumstance. The test is truly. He didn't even find that it was truly. So he's applying a lesser standard and coming out with a lesser determination when a heightened standard.
So he misapplied truly.
He didn't apply truly.
He didn't
apply
truly.
Is that the position you have? That he didn't use the word truly. He just used unusual circumstances. But you don't really have any authority that there's a difference between the two, do you?
Not in this circuit, but in other circuits that have addressed this issue, that have addressed this limited circumstance, the unusual business circumstance, truly unusual. And those courts have routinely said that the situation before them was not truly unusual.
And this was this Kentucky case you were citing. It's not a circuit, but other district courts around the country is what you're saying?
Well, the Kentucky case, McLean, it went up on appeal and the Sixth Circuit affirmed, and they just adopted the district court's opinion. Also in Rifkin v. McDonnell Douglas, the Eighth Circuit, there were two locations that occasionally transferred employees from location to location. It centrally maintained personnel files. They found that nothing more than that present in most large corporations and thus not truly unusual.
Did you argue to the district court, Your Honor, you need to use truly and not just unusual?
We did.
That doesn't seem to be discussed.
We did. We briefed it in a motion for summary judgment. We briefed it in pretrial briefs. The district court had a trial just on the single site issue. And then once it decided that, moved on to other issues in the case. At the single site issue trial, we briefed it in the pretrial briefs. When the court issued its findings of fact, conclusions of law, we filed a motion to amend and to seek permissive appeal, pointing out that the court applied the wrong standard. Interestingly, in its denial, the court, and I quote, "The Fifth Circuit held that under the facts presented in Carpenter's, a truly unusual organization existed." Nowhere in Carpenter's does this court so hold. Again, that's because
it's prior to the labor regulation, isn't
it? It's prior to the change in the standard. In certain courts have asked, the McLean court specifically pointed out, how would the Fifth Circuit rule today? They don't know, but they think that the Fifth Circuit would not so find that it was a truly unusual situation. Again, this heightened standard. Another case that we have cited extensively is the Hooper v. Polychrome case. It's a District Court of Kansas case. It, in our opinion, is the most factually similar case to this one. And in that case, the district court, and I quote, "Nothing truly unusual about Polychrome's structure, i.e. a manufacturing operation in one site and an administrative support office in a separate non-contiguous site. Even if it requires frequent visits to the manufacturing site by support staff employees and periodic visits to the administrative facility by key manufacturing employees." That's the same situation we have here. We have two non-contiguous facilities. Certain key employees from the fabrication yard occasionally would go to the admin building for meetings, and people from the admin building occasionally would go to the fabrication yard to check on projects.
What is the evidence in the record that Signal intended to maintain separate purposes for the administrative site in the Orange Yard?
They always have. The admin started out on Twin City Highway down in Port Arthur. It was there for about 5 years. When the lease was coming to its end, Signal was only using about half of the 100,000 square feet it was using. So in order to economize and move closer to the main shipyard, the one being in Orange, they looked for alternative spaces. They looked at renting a space in a strip mall. They were going to build a building. It was just cost prohibitive. The site that they eventually ended up in, they did look at, but it was owned by the city. the military still had the lease on it. They weren't sure what they were going to do, so it was unavailable. They moved in some trailers immediately adjacent and inside the fence at the fabrication facility. As Philip Davis, the plaintiff in this case, testified, it was cramped quarters and not very conducive to conducting business. There was always the intent to move somewhere if somewhere became available. That facility, the barracks, became available, and Signal moved most of its admin personnel from those trailers over to the admin facility. The fabrication yard builds the products. The admin facility provides support to the fabrication yard.
But you started talking about the facts from another case and in terms of similarities, but you had other facts in this case. In this case, did you not shared security?
There was security that was, it was shared.
Between the two sides?
They did. Security. Initially, they outsourced it. It was subcontractors that did that, but then they hired their own personnel because you only needed one person for security at a time at each facility, so it didn't make sense for the fabrication yard to hire three people and the administration building to hire three people. It was easier to coordinate that one function.
You had shared maintenance.
The maintenance was not shared. The maintenance at the administration facility, they had their own maintenance. The fabrication yard had its own maintenance. Occasionally, if there was a clogged toilet, if a light might be out, they might get an electrician to come over and do some maintenance in the administration facility. If it was something larger, the air conditioning system, something of that nature.
So there was some sharing on an as-needed basis.
Some sharing, but...
Shared payroll?
Shared payroll. It was outsourced to, I think, ADP. But this type of sharing...
Shared IT?
I'm sorry?
Shared IT?
Shared IT, yes, Your Honor. But this sharing in this... This kind of goes into my next analysis that, one, we have the district court applying the wrong legal standard. In its analysis of the unusual business circumstance, it focuses on some of those issues, the two of the factors from Viatar, namely same operational purpose and shared staff. But the case law, the Hooper, Dillard's, all the case law, I'm not, sorry, Dillard's, Dell Champs, they envision there's going to be some sharing. It's not as if each facility must act in a vacuum in order for them to be separate sites of employment. It recognizes and allows that some personnel from one facility are going to have business over at the other, and some personnel from that facility might have business at the fab yard. That's envisioned. And it's supported by, again, by Hooper and some other cases that we cited for you. Again, and with that, it kind of dovetails into our request for relief here. Because the district court applied the wrong legal standard, there in itself, I think this court should reverse. As far as rendering, I think there's ample evidence in the record to show that the district court applied the wrong legal, what has been set forth by the regulations and the other courts in the country addressing this issue, shifting, sharing, however you want to say it, that here...
I can understand that McDonald's would consider, or Starbucks might consider their locations across the street from each other not single, that they would each be single sites. But where the operation is so integrated, I dare say that Signal would certainly consider this a single site.
No, they do not consider collectively.
Oh, Signal wouldn't consider this a single site.
They do not. They consider the fabrication facility to be a single site, the administration facility to be a single site.
What is their separation except for the 1 mile?
The purpose of each. The operational purpose of the admin facility is to provide administrative support to...
What's fabricated?
Fabrication is to build the product. Fabrication yard has the gantry cranes, it has the welders, it has the fitters, it has all that equipment. It's the steel, they build it. Certainly, one is related to the other, but that doesn't necessarily make assembly plant for Ford, all of a sudden a single site with an administrative office in downtown Detroit. Certainly one supports the other and one exists because of the other.
It seems to me consistent with our cases that where the integration of the signal business is this close and mutually dependent, that this could be considered a single site.
I respectfully disagree with you, Your Honor. I'm stating the obvious. But again, looking at the other courts in the country, and the Warren Act itself is not a heavily litigated area of law, at least at the appellate level, and the reported cases district court level. So we're having to look at cases outside of the Fifth Circuit. In all of those cases, they talk about this personnel from one going to the other and one dependent upon the other. And that the Warren Act allows for that. Courts allow for that. It's the rotating, shifting of personnel. It's taking a group of welders and you go work here for 3 weeks and then another group goes and works in another facility or the other facility for 3 weeks. This occasional shifting, it's not that. It's the day in, day out operation of the personnel at each facility. Fabrication, they're focused on getting the product built. Administration, they're going out negotiating contracts, working with the customer if they have a change order, want to do something else to the drilling rig they're building or whatever, pricing the steel, buying the steel so that they can get the best quality for the best price. That's their purpose. Also billing the client and making sure they get paid.
Thank you.
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Terrell, and along with Tommy Yates, we have the privilege to represent the appellees in this matter. I'm going to speak on two separate subjects. First, the single site of employment that y'all asked some questions on earlier, and I'm going to talk about carpenters and how this case is actually more compelling than carpenters. Second, I'm going to explain to you the date for measuring the company size as set out in the CFR and the preamble, and finally discuss the sanctions maybe just briefly in my particular presentation. The first glaring issue that has been pointed out previously is that they state in their brief that the facts are largely undisputed, yet these facts are hotly disputed. In their brief, first they say that the yard and the annex were together temporarily. That contradicts the facts as found by the court, where he said they had stopped looking for another location. Contradicts the statements of Rodney Meschlager, the leading head person at Signal at this facility, where he said they had quit looking for another facility, and the same thing with Mr. Davis, who said this was a permanent facility. They also state in three places in their brief that the admin employees were transferred from the yard to the annex after Ike. Well, that's not true. Some, but not all, of the annex employees were transferred. For example, second in command, Barney Duhon, the second person at this facility, had an office at the yard and spent almost all his time at the yard. I mean, these, not counting the security was the same, the phone was the same, the IT was the same, the security was the same. All these things that Justice Graves pointed out were the same. And there was more sharing than that. The project engineers went to the facility two or three times a week. Many of the admin employees that they classified as admin had offices at the yard after Ike. In fact, Mr. Motzschlager testified, because we didn't get this in discovery, that at the time Mr. Davis was terminated, 24 admin employees were permanently employed at the yard. This is absolutely on the four corners in Carpenter. They
is
state,
that good enough to be on the four corners of Carpenter, or does Carpenter apply a lesser standard than the standard that actually applies?
Carpenter applied the unusual business organization standard, but the court did not. The court says on USCA 514-25, page 3 of his findings of fact, he talks about the Fifth Circuit addressed the truly unusual organization situation in Carpenter. We know the Department of Labor had not come out with those yet.
So if Carpenter is a lesser, they had a lesser standard than you have.
They did have a lesser, truly unusual, truly ambiguous, truly.
Well, they added that word for some reason after the notice and comment.
They did, Your Honor. But the judge on page 10 of his findings refers to the Department of Labor regulations, which we know had truly unusual. So the Carpenter standard may have been a lesser standard or may not, depending on what truly goes with unusual, but the judge applied the Department of Labor standards as he stated in his findings of fact. But our case is much more compelling than Carpenter. In Carpenter, they had some overcrowding, so they moved somebody down the road. They moved from the Bienville, they moved from the canal facility to the Bienville facility, some of the employees, because of overcrowding. In our case, you've got even more compelling. You have them being one contiguous group before Ike. You then have a massive, truly unusual weather phenomenon, the likes of which Orange hasn't seen in decades, wiping out this facility. Now, that's truly unusual. You then have not all, but some of the administrative employees being transferred from the yard to the annex. You don't have all of them. And more importantly, is the annex employees were responsible for only the Orange facility. They weren't responsible for anything company-wide. You combine all these facts and the fact that the number two manager, Barney Duhon, was at the yard, we have a much more compelling case than Carpenter's, because if overcrowding was an unusual organizational structure, then a massive hurricane would certainly be a truly unusual business organization. Combine that with the fact that you have admin, yard workers in the yard, and then in a separate facility, you have some admin employees, and as Justice Gray pointed out, they went continuously to the yard. You've got much more compelling case than Carpenter.
Should we determine it in a snapshot after the hurricane, or should we look at the entire 5-year period that they were separated by 35 miles for most of the time, they were together for only a few months?
The 35 miles is irrelevant. The reason they changed from that facility from 35 miles away is so that they could integrate the staff so that they could work on the projects much easier. When they didn't find a suitable place very close, within a mile, as Justice Reevely pointed out, then they just gave up the look. And at that point, 3 months before, they were permanent.
Well, that's my question. Should you only look at the 3 months before, or should you look at the entire 5 years?
You should only look at the 3 months before. It's what they were at the time.
So it's what they were on that day.
What they were when Ike hit. If it was permanent when Ike hit, that's what you look at. But because, as the court pointed out, they were planning to stay there. Maybe not indefinitely. I mean, you know, nothing's indefinite. But at the time, the testimony was they considered it a permanent single site of employment.
Is there any other case in the whole nation other than this district court determination where someone has found a truly unusual? It's truly unusual to find truly unusual, isn't it?
There's not one, Your Honor, but in the McLean case that they cite, they said it's not truly unusual to have overcrowding. And I don't know what the Fifth Circuit would have done with truly unusual, but I don't think anybody would find that it's not truly unusual when you have a storm surge the likes of which Orange hasn't seen in decades. That is truly unusual.
But does it matter why there's overcrowding or not? The reason behind the overcrowding, I think the point that they're making is that overcrowding, it doesn't matter why. It's just overcrowding.
But the Carpenter's case and the McLean case both said they deal with the overcrowding. In this case, you don't have overcrowding. You got a total demolition of the office building. That's the distinction.
Okay. So you believe this is the one truly unusual case in the nation?
This is the absolutely truly unusual, and I don't know any other case, and we've looked at all of them, that has dealt with something like a massive hurricane and storm surge demolishing the facility.
Okay, and you're not relying on Viator or anything.
I'm not relying on Viator.
You're straight up defending your truly unusual.
Straight up defending my truly unusual, and when they say the judge didn't do it, you can look. He refers to the Department of Labor in his finding. He might not have put truly in front of it, but he referred to the Department of Labor. The second issue I would want to look at is the particular date, and I have to pull out the statute every time I look at this, and I've looked at it 100 times, when you determine company size. It is our position that when you aggregate 90 days, that there's a rule that you go to day one to measure company size, okay? Their position is that you go 60 days before the 90 days to measure company size, okay? If you look at the statute, it says, and I quote, when all employees are not terminated on the same date, the date of the first individual termination within the statutory 30 or 90 day period triggers the 60 day notice requirement. If you read that, it naturally says in a 90 day aggregation, because they weren't terminated on the same day, you go back to day one, okay? It then goes on to talk about 90 days. You look ahead 90 days and behind 90 days. It doesn't say anything about if their interpretation of the 90-day aggregation is correct, then you would have to go back 150 days because they say that you give notice 60 days before the first termination date is their position. And they follow up the next portion of the statute, which we believe deals with terminations on a single day, where it says the point at time which the number of employees to be measured for purposes of determining coverage is the date the first notice is required to be given. We think if you look at it, it's day one, 90 days. The court, Judge Clark, as well as there's a in the Manchester case cited by the appellant, they say consequently, and they're trying to figure out this discrepancy, and they say consequently, I will do my best to interpret definitions that appear to be incompatible, at least in a case with facts like this one. And they were trying to figure out, how do we deal with the 90 days and whether or not a third of the employees were terminated within 30 days, which is a different issue than we have. But they were having a problem with it, just as Judge Clark was having a problem with it. And he followed the precedent in Udall, Fidelity, all the cases that say, if you've got a concern or a question about a regulation and you have a preamble that the Department of Labor created contemporaneously with that regulation, then by all means, we're going to look at it. And when he looks at it, he has the perfect example of our scenario. If you just put our numbers in instead of the numbers in the example, and that's in the preamble. And certainly Judge Clark correctly applied that date. And if you take the numbers as expressed in that date, one-third of the permanent employees were terminated over an aggregate of 90-day period, and there was no 30-day period where 33% of the employees were terminated. Even beyond that, in this case, and this case has been, I guess, a challenge. The appellants have violated a court order from Judge Ward that they said they complied with. They violated a court order from Judge Everingham that they said they complied with. They violated two admonitions from Ron Clark for not producing documents. He had to sanction them $5,000. They told their corporate representative, Tracy Binion, to not testify on crucial issues. The second time we deposed her, based upon Judge Clark's ruling, she said, I know nothing. We asked her these questions about numbers of employees. How do you know this many? I know nothing. And what Judge Clark did, he said, even if I'm not right, though the preamble has the perfect example of our scenario, even if that's not right, there's no evidence of the May date that they want to use as a snapshot date because of their wrongful conduct. They were sanctioned. They say it wasn't a sanction, but in his rulings.
We know what went on. We're familiar with sure. What happened before Judge Ward and Judge Clark wrote. But this is a question of whether it was the layoff within 90 days. And they stipulated that, didn't they?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
Now, that is.
That is very relevant, and I believe the sanctions are relevant as well, Judge, and I will explain if I can, because Judge Clark excluded all evidence of the May date because it, quite frankly, wasn't produced. It was produced late. It was produced in a bad form. But when they finally put all this evidence in the proffer, okay, and they were cross-examined on that evidence that they wrongfully withheld, Ms. Binion admitted that 15 of the employees that they had as permanent employees should have been temporary. In fact, three of the employees that they had on there weren't even employed on their date. And what the judge said, that's where it's relevant. What the judge said is, look, you're not going to hide this evidence. We're not going to encourage defendants to not produce documents, employment records, or testify like they're supposed to. And if they had, and we had taken Ms. Binion's deposition, you would have the proffer, which proves our case even under their stretch standard.
I don't have any trouble with not letting them come in with that list after what had happened. But that's just me. If that's friendly.
I'm sorry.
If that's friendly, and I think it was.
Okay. That's about all
when
I have.
You get a friendly question, you need to fully agree with it.
If there's no questions, I'll give y'all back some time. Thank y'all.
Just to clear up a few points there that were made, with respect to personnel remaining in the fabrication facility, I had mentioned early on that there were some. He mentioned Barney Duhon. That was the person I was referencing, was in charge of the yard. It's just axiomatic that the person in charge of the yard that oversees and the foreman, the superintendents, would be sitest at the yard. There was a comment that you look at the point in time at which admin was in the trailers, the temporary trailers adjacent to the yard, whether or not it was permanent at that time. And Judge Clark, even in his findings of fact, conclusions of law, made the comment that it was not a permanent solution. It was a temporary solution. They rented trailers. Mr. Davis even testified that, again, that it was not conducive to conducting business. I grant it that Ike was an unusual situation. I don't know if it was truly unusual given the history of Rita and Katrina shortly before it, but despite the fact that it was an unusual event, does not create a truly unusual business situation. In fact, I think I submit to you that it's quite common that if a business sustains damage, they're going to move elsewhere. Judge Elrod, you pointed out the fact that if there's overcrowding, how do you solve that? You move people around. If facilities are damaged, whether condemned or if the roof just starts leaking and it keeps leaking, you move elsewhere. The district court never did use the terminology truly. Even if there's some reference to the regs, the court never in its findings of fact, conclusions of law, used the word truly. And it relied upon carpenters. And when we brought that issue to the court's attention and had the chance to say, my analysis was under the current truly standard, and that's what I find truly. No, what it did is it went back and miscited carpenters and said that, well, carpenters found that it was truly unusual. So apparently, Judge Clark is applying the merely unusual standard because nowhere has he used the truly standard, the standard that was applicable in this situation.
Where was the merely unusual?
Merely isn't, I apologize, Your Honor, merely isn't part of it, but I meant to say merely to point out that it doesn't include truly.
Well, I mean, that interested me because I don't know that I would, if I had to determine what the opposite of truly was, and I hope I don't, but I'd like to say falsely. So well, you either have falsely unusual circumstances or truly unusual circumstances, and if they're falsely unusual, then I guess it's obvious.
Right, and as other courts have addressed this, truly, without the word truly terminology in it, have routinely said that the situation does not rise to the level of truly. Obviously, because it is a very, very short and very discreet exception, which the regs even point out, that it's for situations that the DOL could never have envisioned. I don't think that we have that such situation here. Council made comment about the 60-day advance notice. Well, when you look at the 90 days, and it requires that the first date of layoff is when you give the 60-day notice, you count back 60 days from that date of first layoff. And the regs also state that that is the point in time at which you gauge to determine whether there's a mass layoff. If you take this, the suggestion that you do some kind of day one, then the day before you're supposed to lay somebody off, you obviously can't give them the 60-day notice. It turns the act on its head. How can an employer comply if they're allowed to look at the day before they lay somebody off? They're to look 60 days back, well, should I give that employee notice? And it's a rolling 60 days. Next day, they go back 60 days. Next layoff, they go back 60 days. The regulation is clear and unambiguous on its face. Here, the district court, rather than recognizing that clear and unambiguous regulation and applying it here, relied upon the dissent in Linebacker in stating that that was the opinion of the court. That was not the opinion of the court. Something I'd like to point out, though, is there's a distinction in the dissent in Linebacker, is that there was a footnote that was subject to public debate, and the dissent pointed that out to point out the reason why that footnote should get deference. Here, this preamble never was subject to public debate. It appeared in the final version. Nowhere did it appear in any of the initial drafts. On top of that, if the court, which it didn't do, finds that this regulation is ambiguous, it then goes to some kind of interpretation. If that interpretation is contrary to what the regulation provides, you don't give any deference. Here, you have contradiction. If you take this day one approach, it's the day before the layoff. If you go back 60 days, you have a 59-day difference. That is clearly contrary to, there's a contradiction between the two. Rather than going down.
You've used your time.
I did. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.